Okay. Let's get going.
How's everybody doing?
Good.
Anybody have any questions from last time? A few things for people working on projects.
There's certainly a tendency early in your project to really bite off a lot, really to solve a really large problem. But you have to sort of realize that, you know, you only have 8 weeks in the quarter and 2 weeks to the midterm. So it's important for you to sort of match the amount of time that's left with the size of your project. Because you know, if you don't, you're not going to get there. So it's okay not to solve the world's problems, you know, just do what you can do to get this project done. And do it within your means. I don't expect people to learn about microprocessors as a part of their project if they don't already know it. But it's basically you want to use, you know, the skills that you've already have at Stanford, learn from Stanford, and use that in your project. The project goal is to go through the engineering process, to work as a team, to work with people in the community, and to come up with something that's functional and testable and something that you can report on. And as I mentioned, for people working on team projects, the midterm presentations are 2 weeks from today, so keep that in mind. So that means you have to keep moving forward. You know, you may want to do a lot more need finding or brainstorming, but you have to move forward in order to get to where you want to be for the midterm. So you should spend a little time while working on the project to think about your presentation that you're going to do. We're going to have a plan to speak for 10 minutes with questions incorporated into that. And people have been sending me their updates, which is great. Be good to have a few more photos in there so I can see what you're doing as well as hearing what you're doing. And if anybody has any problems at all with their project, they feel like you feel like you're stuck or don't know what to do or just like to talk, get over with me. I'd be happy to sit down with you, as I have with others. So that's good. So Tuesday is going to be a really interesting presentation by Peter Axelson. He's a Stanford graduate. He's an engineer, a mechanical engineer. He uses a wheelchair. He has a company in Nevada, and he has done a lot of assistive technology devices, especially devices for sports. He actually created this ski sledding system, and he did that because he wanted to create a sport that he can excel in by the fact that he created the device to do it. So he'll be talking about that. So not only did he create the ski sledding system, but he created the competition. He created training for people to use it. He created training for other people to train individuals to use that. So he's a real engineer, and he's put his engineering skills to good use. I should also mention that after the class on Tuesday, we're going to be going out to dinner at Max's Cafe. You're welcome to join us on your own dollar, but that's optional. So if you want to get more time with him, that's the thing to do. But today we're going to talk about rehab robots. Professor Okamura is here, and I'll be starting off. I'll be talking about assistive robotics. But the first thing I want to go through is the agenda. So here's what I'm going to be talking about. What is a robot? What is an assistive robot? What is a medical therapy robot? I'm going to show you some photos of very early attempts to create assistive robots. I'm going to go over some projects I did over at the VA, or we did over at the VA. There's also other people's research projects. And some articles about
robots in the news recently from last few months.
We'll have a break, and then Allison will talk about movement therapy robots.
So what image comes to mind when I say robot?
What do you think of? What picture comes in your mind? I'm sure you have a picture.
What kind of robot are you thinking of?
Wall-E.
Wall-E, okay, from the movie. That's fine.
I was going to go with Wall-E.
Oh, I'm sure there's... What's your second choice?
Or like big metal object.
Okay. How about... Okay. Yeah. So how about something that's a real-life robot rather than a movie robot? Go ahead. Oh, Watson. Oh, that's interesting. Do you think the fact that it's mostly software, does that make it a robot or not a robot?
I think it's still interactive.
Okay. So that's a part of the features of a robot. It's interactive. Okay. Anything else? Anybody else have their thought?
iRobot.
Okay. Cindy? Oh, okay. Professor Nelson?
Asimov.
Ah, that's a good one.
That's something I'm surprised people haven't pondered, would not be happy to know that people have not heard about.
Anybody else have a different robot? What is your favorite robot? Your least favorite robot? How about an evil robot?
Roomba.
That's very good. Anybody else?
Well, here's what I thought of robots. Lots of robots, of course.
Rosie the Robot.
This is
K-9 from Doctor Who.
This is a Dalek from Doctor Who. And as you remember, there's an alien in here, but he's not strong enough to live on his own, so this is the ultimate exoskeleton robot, you know, so the alien is inside there. And here's Asimo and Data, Lieutenant Commander Data.
And the Doctor.
Of course, Data is a real robot, looks a lot like a human, and if you remember, the Doctor
is just a hologram.
And here's PR2, here's a prosthetic arm, and here's Roomba. How about Kit, the car robot? Okay, remember that? And this is a mechanical robot that
serves tea, so it has no computer,
and it's just a mechanical clockwork. Here's a robot that's in manufacturing. Here's Asimo. Here's a robot that functions as navigation for wheelchair. Here's a Da Vinci robot that does surgery. That's a local company. Here's a robot that looks
too real,
perhaps. And here's R2-D2 and 3-CPO. And this is a telepresence robot. We'll see this... Texi robot and PR2
when we go over to
Willow Garage. And of course, everybody knows.
Well, not everybody knows.
But this is from the day the Earth stood still. And so this robot had a visor which raised up, and he had lots of
laser pointers that destroyed people.
So he had. And so, in order to get him to stop doing that, you'd have to say, Clock to Barada Nito.
So if you ever encounter this robot, that's what you have to say, and then he won't destroy you, right?
Okay. So, but what defines a robot? So I was thinking about it. You know, what common elements do robots have? What are the features they have, and what don't they have? Well, you know, a lot of robots move, and either by walking or have wheels, or some. I've seen robots that fly, some that, you know, will dig into the ground to swim.
Orbit the Earth.
Certainly, a lot of robots have the ability to sense, so they have some vision sensor, hearing,
and they have other kinds of input
that it's used to make the robot be able to sense what's going on. And the ability to manipulate either through hands, arms, fingers, or some other means is probably important for some robots. The ability to mimic, to make it
look like another human, is important
in some situations. And make it do human tasks might be something that a robot is built for. and certainly would have to communicate with you somehow, by voice or sounds, or by sending signals or video or something. A lot of robots have brains in there, and they could be, you know, computer brains, could be a mechanical mechanism, and maybe computers have can act like they're self-aware. So that's what a lot of those other robots that I showed you do. They appear to have such complex programming that they're acting on their own. How do they operate? Well, there's a number of robots that
mimic exactly what you do. I remember robots that are used in the nuclear industry where there's a barrier between you and the radioactive stuff, and you put your hands in there and you can use it as a master-slave mechanism to pick up the radioactive material at a distance. Some have are programmed to do specific things, and some sort of work autonomously that can do things on their own. But I think in general, robots have the ability to react and respond to different situations. A lot of times, maybe they're doing the same thing all the time, but you know, a more functional robot might be able to work in different conditions. But I think in general, the ability to do something useful goes without saying. It's got to be useful in some way. And we touched upon this. Can a software program be a robot? Does anybody... How many people agree to that? Is Siri a robot? Would you consider that a robot? Yes? No? If not, why not? Because it doesn't have a body, it doesn't move around. I mean, it doesn't have a lot of things that I mentioned here, but it does have a personality, which is something. And it does respond to you, give you good information. So it has some of these characteristics, but not all. So, you know, basically... So what is the definition of a robot? Well, from Wikipedia, it says a robot is a mechanical or virtual agent. So it could be something physical or a virtual agent. That could be something not physical. That can perform tasks automatically or with guidance, typically by remote control. A lot of robots are electromechanical machines guided by a computer and programming. They can be autonomous, semi-autonomous, or remotely controlled. Robots can look like human, like an Asimo, and they can be very small robots. You can have lots of robots, industrial robots, military robots, mobile, and servicing robots. So maybe they service people in some way. Some of them mimic lifelike appearance, and a robot may convey a sense that it's a person of its own and can do things on its own. So what is an assistive robot? My colleague Mike van der Loos said an assistive robot performs a physical task for the well-being of a person with disability. The task is in the context of normal human activities of daily living that would otherwise be performed by an attendant. So a robot substitutes, in this case, for an attendant in doing something. But the person with a disability controls the robot. My definition is a little bit shorter. Assistive robot is a device that can sense, process information, and performs actions that benefit people with disabilities and seniors. So maybe that's a little bit more inclusive. Allison's going to talk about movement therapy robots, and I thought as long as I was in the defining mood,
I'd come up with a definition for a movement therapy robot, one that is specifically designed to provide a diagnostic, that is, it's measuring something or assessing something on a person with a disability, or provides a therapeutic functional improvement benefit. So what are the kinds of assistive robotics? Well, they fall into two categories, fixed and mobile. Fixed robots are sitting in one position all the time, and then you interact with them by going to them. It could be a workstation where a robot helps you do vocational tasks as if you were on the job or as a student. It could help you do those tasks at a desk. It can also help you with activities of daily living, you know, such as washing your face or brushing your teeth, things like that. It can help with serving you food, providing medicine, and improving your health. And mobile robots can move around. They can be autonomous. They can be programmed to carry things for you, to get things for you, to bring them to you if you're in bed and can't get out of bed. Some of them can help you walk if you're in need of an aid to support you. There's some robots that will do that. I have examples of all of these. There's a bunch of mobile robots that are on wheelchairs that provide navigation assistance that help you if you're unable to control the wheelchair yourself. It'll find your way around the room for you. And there's others that have an onboard robotic arm to pick things up for you. So, who could use an assistive robot? Well, lots of people. The people who have spinal cord injury or paralysis, people with cerebral palsy or arthritis, people that are just frail, people with diseases such as ALS, multiple muscular dystrophy, multiple sclerosis, people who've had a stroke or maybe a temporary impairment, and people who have a limb amputated could use an assistive robot. So there's lots of people that can use a robot of this sort. So let's go into some of the robots that have been around. This one is, it's got to be like 60s. This is a robotic arm that's attached to a wheelchair. And it's not a prosthetic arm because you can see that the person has their entire arm, but maybe the arm is weak or paralyzed. So it's a motorized arm that provides movement, and she controls it by switches that are up near her chin or mouth. And this is a very early robotic arm. This is actually several prototypes after the first one, but it was actually built upon a prosthetic arm. So they took a prosthetic arm and they motorized it, and then they set it up in this on this workstation, and you can control it via a computer. And you notice that the end effector is a hook, a prosthetic hook. So very early start of looking at robots like this, using robots. Now, we did a bunch of robotics projects at the VA. This was one of the early ones we did. So we took an existing Unimation arm. We had an end effector manufactured that provided a grip and added onto it a mobile base that had an LSI 11 computer in here. I also want to point out these wheels here. These are special wheels. These are wheels that on the outside of the wheel, there's actually several independent rollers. So with wheels like this, you can actually move in two directions. By controlling the speed and direction of the wheels, this mobile robot can move off in any direction. It doesn't have to turn. It can just move in that direction. So it's an omnidirectional robot. And we made a wheelchair based upon these wheels as well. And this was controlled remotely over RF from a base station by a person with a disability, a severe disability. So this was a mobile manipulation aid for people with disabilities. Question? Yes?
What sort of purpose did it perform for people with a disability?
It's supposed to pick up things for them, bring them back to them so they can use them. Okay. But mostly, we did one video here actually in this building, that we had the robot go across the room by voice control, pick a flower out of a flower pot, and bring it back. I mean, it took like an hour to do that.
So it wasn't super practical because...
No, that wasn't that long ago.
No, I'm just kidding. That's pretty impressive even today.
Yeah, it was. But it took a lot of commands to do that. I mean, there's a lot of degrees of freedom, so each of those degrees of freedoms had to be voice controlled. Here's a workstation, a vocational workstation. So the idea is that a person with a severe disability who didn't have use of his hands can provide do a job. And in this case, this job was an educational job. And this is not a giant CD. It's actually what was called a video disc. Who remembers video discs? Okay.
Just the older folks.
So the robot is hanging from this the structure here and has the ability to move across the structure so it can have a wide volume of stuff within its reach. And it could grab the video disc and put it in the player over here. It could also pick up floppy disks. And the idea here was to provide a learning environment for people to learn about desktop publishing and things like that. And he was able to control the thing with a mouse stick, and there's a mouse up here and a keyboard down here. Here's some other views of this. You can see the robot arm a little bit better here. Again, it was voice controlled. With this device, there was a bunch of pre-programmed routines that were in there. So you can say, get the floppy disk, and it would know, where the floppy disk was, and would perform all the steps to get it and to insert it into the computer. Here's the same system a little bit later as a vocational aid, and this was actually installed at this guy's job location at Pacific Gas and Electric, and he had the computer do things like picking up the phone, answering the phone, and bringing it to the person's ear, feeding him. In here there was some throat lozenges because he needed throat lozenges because he was performing all these commands, audible commands to the robot, and again, his voice got hoarse doing that. It could pick up printings, listings, and go through the listings. Later on, there was had a microwave oven up here, and it was able to open a door to the microwave oven and key in how long to have the oven go for, and take the bowl of soup out of there and serve him soup for lunch.
Yeah. How much do
these systems cost? Too much.
I think the robot arm was $20,000
just by itself. So this was a research device, but I'll get into the economics of these robots at a later time. Allison?
At what level is the robot autonomous as compared to the human giving very low-level instructions or high-level instructions?
They were, like I said, they were high-level instructions. They were to do a task. So you tell it, do this task or that task. And the robot was pre-programmed to, with a sequence of events, it knew where to go and how to operate.
And could the user program it?
There was a version, which is on the next slide, as a matter of fact. The slide after this. So this one actually, was hooked up. This robot was hooked up to the phone, a speaker, a microphone, an environmental control unit, so it could turn on and off lights. The whole system could, not the robot. This TTK is actually a tongue-touch keyboard. And this was a in-mouth set of switches that were that you can hit with your tongue to cause certain actions to happen. And there was a headmaster is a head position device that was used to control the computer, the mouse on the computer, a commercial device. Later on, they worked on an interface for it so that the user could program the robot to go to with a sequence of commands, they'll perform a task. So the user was able to do that themselves. Moving away from the VA, there's a bunch of other ones that were either research robots or robots that were available commercially for a while. This is a robot that was set up for feeding tasks, applying makeup, washing the face and stuff, and was controlled by a single switch. This is the only picture I've ever seen of this, so I don't think it was a commercial success at all. The Manus robot has gone through several iterations. It's a accessory to a power wheelchair so that the person can manipulate things from their wheelchair, like pick up keys, drop keys, or pick up a cup or something. This particular one had this keyboard and display here, and the ones that I've seen now have a joystick that control all the movements. But it's still pretty laborious because you have to control all these degrees of freedom at the same time, and it's really hard to do. It's like operating a bulldozer or something. There's so many different levers and stuff to do. This one is also very large, has this huge backpack. But the ones nowadays are much smaller. Sorry.
I was struck by a remark in a piece I saw about a NASA thing for doing manipulations in space,
right,
which said that 5 or 6 degrees of freedom was really great for engineers, but it turned out that it was much easier for the operators to learn ones that had exactly the same motions as a human arm,
right,
because they knew how to do that.
Right. Yeah.
And they couldn't get their minds around all of the other degrees of freedom that
right.
the machines were capable.
No, that's right. You know, a robot, has individual motors that perform, one motion. And typically a control for that would be to move, this axis and then that axis and then, this axis and stuff like that. And that's very unnatural. So if you had a mechanism that would, monitor your entire arm and mimic that with the robot, then that would be a lot more intuitive. So you're right. So this is another wheelchair-based manipulator. And you see it has less degrees of freedom. It's 4 instead of 5. And a very simple end effector. Some of these things I've looked up and aren't available anymore. So even though it says commercialized in 2001, I doubt it if it's really on the market. This is another prototype wheelchair arm that is probably not available anymore. It's supposed to be more inexpensive, but it's really bulky. I mean, you wouldn't want to go around in that. There's these wheelchairs that are set up to provide navigation. So that presumes that the wheelchair user does not know how to navigate the environment, maybe because they're visually impaired or don't have the mental capacity to operate a joystick. So you put a lot of sensors on there, and it determines where the obstacles are, and it can either find its way autonomously, or you can sort of tell it, that you want to go to a specific location, and it will get you there. Here's another one. This looks like one of those autonomous cars using a laser rangefinder and stuff like that. But this is just a research device. I've seen this one operation. But again, very bulky prototype. This one looks a little bit better. It has eye tracking interface. It has a vision system and infrared sensors, ultrasonic sensors. Shaft encoder so it can figure out where it is in the room, and an instrument in the front bumper. I looked this up and it's nowhere to be found, so it was somebody's research project. Same with this one. Robots can be used to just grab things and carry them for you. If you use a walker, maybe you need something to put your food on while you're using the walker to get to the table. So a robot like this could come in handy. And this one says it's a walking assist for the elderly, but it looks pretty scary to me. I'm not sure I'd want to be helped by that one. Here's another walking assist robot. So this is more like an instrumented walker where there are sensors on here, and it figures out in which direction there are obstacles. And it won't let you go in the direction with the obstacles. So it's physically hard to, turn it into a wall or something. So it's easy to move, straight ahead where there's a free path. So there's been a couple versions of this, and I doubt that this is commercially available either. So let's get into some...
Somebody have a question?
Let's get into some more recent developments. PR2 is a robot that's made by Rural Garage, and
we'll be having a tour of their facilities. You'll be seeing that in person.
And so a lot of, they gave away about a dozen of these robots to people all over the world to have them, program it to do interesting things. And now you can use your robot to get you a sandwich from Subway and even go to Japan to get the sandwich for you. So that's sort of interesting. Here's PR2, fold and close, can set a table and bake cookies. Now you have to sort of, you know, put your mind around this. Well, I can do all these things, and do I really need to buy a $200,000 robot to do these things for me if I can't do it? So there's a, you have to think about the economics of a situation like this. And this robot, as you'll see, is physically large and maybe too large to have at home. There's a whole mess of these exoskeletons that are wearable bionic devices that assist people in walking. And Fernanda can testify to how well they work. So what this does is it provides forces that enable you to walk. And typically, you're not walking on your own, but you have a walker in front of you to provide balance. And there's about a half a dozen projects like this around the world. There's one in Israel. There's a couple in Berkeley and other places. Here's a student at Berkeley who was hooked up to one of these systems, and there's a nice video showing him getting his diploma when he graduated. So that was big time stuff. A lot of this work came out of military use. So if you wanted to be a real super soldier, you put out one of these exoskeletons, both arms and legs, and then if you had to do push-ups, it'd be real easy to do because the robot is doing them for you. So I'm not sure what sense that makes.
How about sit-ups?
I'm not sure. It doesn't seem to be a whole lot of motors around the hips, between the hips and the body, so that may be an issue. But there were exoskeletons that would essentially be around you. The GE. GE did one many, many years ago. And one guy in the world knew how to operate it. So complex. I threw this one in there because it's sort of different and interesting. So this is a device that provides vibration over here, and it's supposed to help you improve your sense of touch. It was unclear from the article how the glove figured out what it was touching, and here's a bunch of different sandpaper samples. So, you know, a robot doesn't have to, you know, look like a robot. It can be something like this. There are robots that are set up to be to work with kids and whose main output is changes in expression to deal with people and kids and stuff like that. This robot is your exercise buddy. Okay, so it's telling you you're supposed to mimic what the robot is doing, and it's following an exercise pattern and stuff. And it actually has a camera on it that figures out if you're doing that right or not, and will stop and will say you're not doing that right. So, sort of funny looking. And there's a bunch of these robots that are telepresence robots that can connect somebody who's in bed with their doctor or with people via Skype over the internet. So, and it's mobile, so it can walk around and serve lots of different people in a hospital setting. It could be used at home as well.
How large?
I would
say it's probably about this high.
There's several of these around. There's Little Garage makes one, and there's another local company who makes one that AnyBots makes one that looks like a Segway. It balances on two wheels. And there's actually an individual who works in Texas, Four Wheel Garage, who commutes by telepresence to Will Garage using one of these robots. So you see, you know, you go and you see him in the corridor and stuff like that, and you say hi to him, but you know, he's actually in Texas. There's a hair washing robot. Leaves your hair silky smooth, and it has 24 fingers, and you can set it up for, do you want what kind of shampoo do you want? Do you want conditioner and stuff like that? So that's sort of funny, but you know. Dealing with people in a hospital setting or a home setting, you know, they have to bathe themselves, they have to wash their hair, so this could be useful. this is really neat. This is a Panasonic robotic bed. So it solves the problem of being the problem of transferring from your bed to a wheelchair by having it sort of incorporate, the design incorporates a wheelchair that changes shape, transforms. It's a transformer, transforms into a powered wheelchair. So that's sort of interesting. And then, of course, there's lots of prosthetic aids that have computers in them. There's ankles, there's knees, there's whole robotic legs that that sort of figure out the best way to work to make you walk as efficiently as possible. And they're getting better and better and lighter weight. There's a bunch of prosthetic arms and hands. This one is a DARPA one. Looks like this is carbon fiber. This is one by Applied Physics Lab and Johns Hopkins. There's several that, some of them are operated by residual EMG signals in the part of the arm that you remain. So you tense that muscle, electrodes pick up that signal and operate the arm. And there's others that work by mind control. So you think about it and it picks up your thoughts, your alpha waves and patterns of thinking, and will move for you. This is another interesting robot. This robot can pick you up off the floor. And you know, picking up people in a hospital is really a real tough job. Moving them from place to place, you know, for changing linens and stuff. So you really need something like this to do that. And here they've made it into a robot. Interesting. And then there are therapeutic robots for kids or elderly that, you know, perform some kind of, that either vibrate or purr or something as you interact with them to provide something for kids to do or elderly to do. Security blanket, so to speak. There's a bunch of these around. And a lot of times kids with autism can interact better with a robot than with other folks. So there's been some people working in that area as well. So here's PR2 scratching Henry Evans' face for the first time. And I sort of brought this up because Professor Leifer, you know, saw that as a need as well, to be independent, to be able to do things as simple as scratching yourself. So if you're a person with who has quadriplegia, that might be an issue for you. And you find robots any place. You find them in the classroom. You find robot contests, the first competition. They're also a part of learning, at classroom assistant tomorrow. So let's sort of put all this stuff together. Economics of assistive robots. Well, Mike Vanderloos did a study on this, and he found that even an expensive robot could be amortized over time if it replaces an attendant for a significant part of that time. So rather than paying an attendant, you're buying a robot. Okay. And if you're doing robotics research, we all know that you have to work with people that would be the ultimate users, the intended user population. And also, in this case, you're going to be, if it's going to be used in a hospital setting, you have to introduce people in the hospital, you know, to the robot, make them a part of the process so that it's their project as well as your project. And you get good input from users as well. And people who do research, you know, need to present their findings in presentations and publications. Future of robots. You know, everybody wants the best possible care, so maybe robots can't provide that. I don't know. A lot of healthcare is now is at home and is up to the person to do. Since we're all getting older, there's going to be more people with disabilities, lack of caregivers. And if a robot can provide better medical care, that could, you know, help extend people's lives and make their lives, improve their lives and improve their independence. Robots will be cheaper in the future as more of them are made. And they'll have lots of technology built into them. So in summary, robots come in many forms, can be used in lots of different ways to help people with disabilities. There's lots of research being done, lots of prototypes out there, but few of them have really reached the market. And all of them are very expensive, and it's unclear how beneficial they might be for people. And so that's the challenges that people have now. So we'll take a break, and we'll set up for Allison and take some final questions.
I'd just like to share the fact that in experiencing testing are a lot of a wearable robotics suit, and I'm working with exobionics. And what's interesting is when we think of robot, it's very big and cumbersome and clunky with a lot of metal and hardware around things. But what I found very fascinating in the design and incorporating movement in robotics is that the unit itself is anywhere from 45 to 50 pounds. So thinking about adapting that for a frail body to be encased in it, it almost like, where's the logic, where's the rationale here?
And how long does it take to put on?
Right. And physically, at this level where exobionics is, it's not, you can't really put it on by yourself yet, you need the system. But what I found truly impressive about this experience is that I see a unit that is about 45 pounds, and I'm looking at it like, my gosh, how is that going to be able to move me? But once I'm strapped in, ready to go, I'm standing up, walking with it, I don't feel ounce of that 50 pounds. From an engineering point of view, there's that plays into this, not just the solution base of it, but it comes to the material, how lightweight it is for that, so that it can follow a formula for the movement, and at the same time the user going through a rehabilitation process can follow that movement in generating a movement as far as walking. So to me, that was the most impressive aspect about it, is that here's a unit that is looks so hardcore and very intimidating, absolutely intimidating. And then to wear it and then to be able to glide along with it was two different worlds of dimension once it's being used, and also when somebody's watching you walk. Because all of that becomes, it removes the clunkiness of the robotic patterns. And it's still, you know, it's still going through its evolution. And at this point, I've been testing it now for a year, and I've gone to three prototypes for this. And the way they're immersing this to the market is partnering with rehabilitation hospitals in different parts of the country. And from that, the unit's going to be used as a study case to further, as a antibiotics. We can't really claim studies, but we have test pilots with different variations of ability with their physicality, from somebody who can't really move to somebody like myself who can't move somewhat. And that piece also is very important, because then the engineers can get an idea where the range is for the use for this, you know, particular device, because not really everybody can use it. If you guys want to talk about robotics, I can talk about it a lot more.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you. Okay. Okay. 2 minutes. Oh, sorry, I went so long. Me. Yeah, we took. Yeah.
Quick microphones.
So this is my phone. Are you recording or just a... Okay. Am I good? Okay. And we're ending at 5:30 sharp, right?
You can go over.
That's okay. I can keep it. I'm going to move this a little bit because I tend to walk in front of the board. I'm ready to go whenever you are.
Ready?
Yep.
Okay, let's get started again. I want to introduce Professor Okamura. She received her BS degree from the University of California at Berkeley in 94, and her MS and PhD degrees from Stanford in 96 and 2000. All in mechanical engineering. Currently a new associate professor in the mechanical engineering department here at Stanford. She was previously a professor and vice chair of mechanical engineering at Johns Hopkins and has been an associate editor of the IEEE Transaction on Haptics, an editor of the IEEE International Conference on Robotics and Automation, and co-chair of the IEEE Haptics Symposium. Lots of awards, including 2009 IEEE Technical Committee on Haptics Early Career Award, 2005 IEEE Robotics and Automation Society Early Academic Career Award, 2004 NSF Career Award. She's an IEEE Fellow, and her interests include haptics, teleoperation, virtual environments, and simulators, medical robotics, neuromechanics, rehabilitation, prosthetics, and engineering education. So let's welcome.
Thanks. Well, thanks a lot for having me, Dave, and I was delighted to hear your discussion of assistive robotics, which is not a topic I know that much about. My expertise in robotics, sort of growing up as a faculty member at Johns Hopkins, was really mostly in surgical robotics, and I did a lot of work in teleoperated robot-assisted surgery and robots that steer needles to hit targets deep in the body. But about 4 years ago, I started working with a neuroscientist who approached me because she works with patients who have damage to the cerebellum, which is a really important part of the brain that's used for controlling movement. And so over the last few years, I've learned a lot about movement therapy robots, and I'd like to give you a brief overview of the field. Provided in part through discussions with Dave and my friend Mike Vanderloos, who's a professor at University of British Columbia, and then sort of take you through one of the research projects that I've done using a robot to do brain science and a very preliminary kind of movement therapy for patients with damage to the cerebellum. So, Now, stroke is the big one. We already talked a little about the demographics of patients that might be able to use robots. And I'm specifically now looking at patients who have movement deficits. And there are lots of, many more than even here, of types of patients that need to use movement therapy and rehabilitation. But stroke is the big one in terms of a major economic impact on this country. So many of you probably know someone close to you who's had a stroke, whether it's a grandparent or even yourself. Because stroke is such a large economic problem and affects so many people, this talk is mostly going to focus on stroke. So if you're going to rehabilitate a person who has a movement deficit due to some kind of damage in the brain, there are a lot of potential ways that you can do it and a lot of different things that you need to consider. So, and forgetting about robots at all, even when people help rehabilitate someone, it's not really known what is optimal. And if you actually look at very prestigious medical publications like the New England Journal of Medicine, there are very few publications about rehabilitation. It's actually developed as a relatively kind of ad hoc medical field, and in part because it's hard to do rehab science because every patient is different. And so it's hard to understand general rules or laws for how you should rehabilitate someone. So in some ways, robotics provides an opportunity to do diagnosis and record very precise data about what's going on with particular patients. And the hope is that can be used to drive therapies that are very patient-specific. So some of the variables that you might want to consider in designing some sort of therapy for a patient include the quantity, duration, intensity, and types of tasks that you want to rehab a patient for. And then the robot itself, which will be interacting physically with the patient, could be doing a number of different things. So let's say I'm a patient, a stroke patient, who has trouble reaching from here to here. Either my movements are too slow, or I can't move in a straight line, or I have intention tremor. And so the robot might be able to assist my movement by just pushing me there. Then the question is that really a strategy for rehabilitation, or is that an assistive robotic device like the kind that Dave was talking about? And while there is something known as use-dependent learning, which is what we learn when we practice shooting lots of basketball hoops before a basketball game, so practicing something and just moving it or having someone move us might help us learn, but you know, maybe that's not ideal, especially for some patients. Then there's also a strategy where you challenge the movement. So you have a patient who has trouble moving this way. The robot pushes on them in a way that makes it even harder to move, and so the patient has to then work harder to overcome that. That has a lot of challenges in terms of motivating patients and figuring out what is the right way in which to challenge their movement. But what it does is it pushes the patient further toward recovery. You can also, in a way, sort of assisting movement, but simulate normal tasks. That is, have the robot move the hand around to do something that might be like an activity of daily living. And then there's the area of sort of socially assistive robotics, where you do non-contact coaching, sort of like the USC robot that was helping with exercise mentioned earlier. So these are all ways in which robots might be able to help in movement therapy. Mike Vanderloos has a really nice way of describing the progression of the field in rehab robotics, so I'll just walk you through this a little bit before I talk about my research project. So early work started by just trying to replace a human therapist and then augment the therapist. Finally, the robot can do things that a therapist can't even imagine doing. And then finally, I'll explain what this means, enabling the inner therapist. So replicating the therapist, here are a few examples. This is the MIME robot, and this was something that was developed here at Stanford and the Palo Alto VA. I think Dave talked a little bit about teleoperated robots, where you move a master and a remote robot tries to mimic that motion. In the MIME system, you actually teleoperate yourself. So with one hand, you will move a joystick, and you can therefore control the movement of your other hand. And the idea is somehow that will help reconnect brain circuits that have somehow been broken in the process of having a stroke. And you can really program this sort of system in many different types of modes, but the novel thing about this device was that you can kind of develop your own movement therapies by using your non-paretic limb, your good hand, to control the not-so-good. Although there have been very few commercial successes, I'm not sure you can quite call this a success, but this MIT Manus robot has probably been the best commercially successful robot in that it's a company that's been around for at least 5 or 6 years and seems to still be alive in one form or another. And they've created a very simple movement therapy robot that allows you to do kind of planar reaching tasks and provides force fields that can either assist you or resist you. So the robot can be programmed in different ways. And so sometimes the difficulty you have to look at when people say, oh, rehab robots don't work, is it the robotic device itself or the manner in which it's assisting? And people have used this robot to try a number of different types of assistance methods. And there are ways that you can evaluate patients and how well they're doing in activities of daily living or movement tasks. And one of those is the Fugle-Meyer score. And so a lot of, if you read any of these papers about rehab robots, they're often trying to report Fugle-Meyer scores and what happened right after training versus what happened 4 weeks later, how much of what was learned was actually retained by the patient. And they had some pretty decent results with this robot. Just as another example of a system, this time from another sort of big leader in the field of rehab robotics, which is the Rehab Institute of Chicago. They've developed other kinds of robots with different degrees of freedom that basically allow you to do the same kinds of things as the MIT Manus. And so let's get on to now augmenting the therapist. So all of those robots are kind of holding onto the arm and replacing things that a therapist might be able to do. So by augmenting the therapist, what I mean is letting the patient do fun things on their own, which might actually help them extend their training beyond what they would normally do with a therapist. And in fact, Dave, this was actually a project that you helped on. Do you actually want to say a few words? I've got two slides about this project. You're welcome to.
Cells at the ends here that figure out how much force you're providing, and the steering wheel can resist you, can be programmed to resist you to provide exercise for your weak side. Mm-hmm. So it's very clever in that respect that that you use the steering wheel as the modality of providing exercise for you. Mm-hmm. And
it was a fun game too.
Yeah, it's a fun game. Yeah. Yeah. Sort of the strategy, it was a lot different than just moving around and hitting targets and stuff that actually you know, engaged you in driving tasks.
Yep. Thanks, Dave. So there are other robots in other configurations that have also tried to involve video games. This is a system which is actually based on a large haptic robot. A haptic robot, which is a thing that I've worked on in my lab quite a bit, is a device that allows you to feel forces in a virtual environment. So the super therapist now is the idea that the robot can record a lot of data and use that data in really intelligent ways. So I won't be able to go through all the details on this, but here's the idea. Let's say a patient has a task of moving from one starting target to another target, but they can't quite move that way, and so they might veer off in one direction. So let's say you provided a kind of challenge to them by having forces that push them off even further off of their desired path. And so these are just examples of paths that subjects might take under different types of these force fields. And so if they train a lot in this extra perturbed force field, and then you took that force field away, would they then, what they learned in terms of their correction, would it actually correct their original movement to be a straight one? And by analyzing the movements very carefully and sort of building a model of the deficit of that specific patient, these researchers are actually able to design a weird virtual force field, which has no basis in the sort of reality of forces that we might experience in the real world, but it would just manage to make them move their arm just right. Now, the challenge in this research, actually, is the issue of transference, which is that you can learn to do a task and get this motor learning going in a specific device, but then once you leave the clinic, actually applying that into activities of daily living, we don't know how to do that yet. So although we get really nice results in a very restricted, controlled setting that we can correct movement deficits of someone with a stroke, actually correcting the movement deficits in general and when you've left the machine is still a very open problem. It's yet to be solved. And one way in which people are trying to solve this is by instead of having people sit in a robot and making the user feel like they're in an environment that is all about this robot and therefore associating what they learn with that context. Instead, people try to make very realistic now virtual environments, cave-like environments, where maybe this user doesn't actually see the robot that they're interacting with. They see some cool virtual environment that they see through the goggles. And so by trying to make the training environment in many degrees of freedom and being an environment that appears as much as possible like the real world and sort of deletes the visual of the robot, could you then get better transference? And this is still really an open research question and one that has to be solved if this if these rehabilitation robotics are ever going to get used. So finally, I only have one slide on enabling the inner therapist, and this has come out really just in the last couple of years, is the idea of using affect to change behavior. So affect has to do with mood, and you can think of this going along two different axes. One is valence, and one is arousal. So if you have very negative valence and high arousal, you know, you're kind of angry. And conversely, if you have very low arousal but your valence is sort of in the middle, then you're sleepy. And in getting patients to continue a rehab scheme or to provide the right kind of assistance or resistance to them, these robots are actually now recording data like galvanic skin response to try to measure some of the mood, basically, of the person that's using the robot and adjust the therapy accordingly. So I just actually, because I've mostly been talking about upper limb therapy robots, I just wanted to show a few slides of lower limb movement therapy robots. And they're pretty clunky and scary looking, much like some of the robots that Dave showed. This is the most commercially successful one, the Locomat. It's used, I believe, in a number of hospitals in Europe and maybe just a couple here in the U.S.
VA has one.
Ah, okay, great. But I would say it's still controversial in terms of how much this robot has actually improved patient health. Is there any definitive feeling about it at the VA that people think that it really has helped?
Even last year, Dr. Creasy had doubts about its effectiveness.
Yeah.
So there needs to be more studies to show how effective it actually is.
And one of the thoughts is that a lot of these lower limb robots, again, move the leg through some set pattern, and the thought now in the field is that maybe you should resist the motion, make the user work hard to overcome actually robot forces, and then you might have some kind of plastic learning. You can use the plasticity of the brain to learn a new movement and create new brain circuits. This is a balance training robot, which also looks very scary, that you're very stepped in there, but that they've used not only as a potential therapeutic tool, but again, as a way of diagnosing the patient. So if you can perturb the patient and see how they respond, that might help you build a model. You know, when I say a model, I mean a mathematical model that describes the movement deficit. So I'm just going to spend the last few minutes talking about a research project that I did with some neuroscientists at Johns Hopkins and the Kennedy Krieger Institute. And the Kennedy Krieger Institute is a hospital specifically for patients with brain and spine disorders back in Baltimore. And the idea is patients with damage to the cerebellum who might move like this, we would like them to move from the center to targets much more like a control user. So the cerebellum is a part of the brain back here at the base, and in some ways it's a mystery. We don't know exactly what it does, but we know that it's absolutely essential to movement control. If the cerebellum is damaged, you see that a control subject who might move from here to here with fairly straight movements, if you have damage, you might swing out and you would overshoot and maybe come back, and you also have more variability. So here's an example, I hope this works, of a patient with cerebellar damage, and he's doing a chin-to-finger test, and he has these interesting oscillations. And let me explain that although the cerebellum is a very specific part of the brain, it can get damaged from stroke, it can also be damaged from trauma or through genetic diseases. The experiments that we did in the work I'll show you are actually all done with patients who had a genetic disorder, except for maybe one trauma, where only the cerebellum was affected. One of the real challenges of stroke is it affects lots of different parts of the brain. If you have a blood clot in your brain and you lose oxygen, you will get damage in many, many different parts of the brain, not just the cerebellum. But the cool thing about the cerebellum is that there are specific hypotheses about how it helps control movement. And so if we can test those and understand exactly how the cerebellum works, then that's really a first step towards doing model-driven treatment for patients with stroke. So the thought is that the cerebellum houses a model of the body. And so you can think of the model of the body just sort of sitting there in the cerebellum. And I mean a dynamic and kinematic model. Now, if you are a control person, that is, you don't have damage to your cerebellum, the idea is that that model sitting in the cerebellum would directly match the real physical model of your arm, the inertias, the link lengths, limb segment lengths. I'm a roboticist. You can tell when I call them links. And so the thought is that when the cerebellum is damaged, you might get some bias in this model. And so maybe your cerebellum thinks, my limb is twice as heavy or twice as big as it actually is. And so one of our questions was, although this has been a long-time hypothesis, it's never really been tested before. So we wanted to know, can we look at the movements of patients with damage to the cerebellum, and do they actually correspond to the cerebellum having a bias in the estimate of limb dynamics? So bias is one problem. Another problem is variability. You saw that the cerebellar patient's movement was more variable than the control. And so this variability is also going to affect the movements that you see. So here's some more examples of control and cerebellar subjects comparison. These are very classic center-out tasks where they go to different targets, in this case, 10 o'clock, 12 o'clock, and 2 o'clock. And what you can do is sit a patient or a control subject in an exoskeleton robot. Speaking of big, clunky metal robots, this one looks pretty scary. But when you move in it, it's actually very lightweight. The parts that move when you make these planar motions in the robot are very smooth, and it doesn't really feel like you're sitting in this big robot. But all of the support structure in this case is needed. And I have to say, one of the things that's so impressive about what groups like Berkeley Bionics have done is that they've managed to get away from all of this clunkiness into something that you really could wear around or put in the trunk of your car. This is really quite a big structure here, but it's sort of appropriate for the lab because you can use it in different ways. So anyways, you have patients make these movements in the robot, and the robot allows you to record their movements. And then you can do some fancy inverse dynamics calculations. So if you can measure the shoulder angle and the elbow angle, you can do an inverse dynamics calculation and compute the shoulder torque and the elbow torque. And then you can look at those torques and compare them to what they should have been in order to match the model of the arm versus what they actually were. So here's an example of a simpler case where the subject now is just moving one joint. And even with this very simple motion, we still see deficits in these cerebellar patients. So a typical control showed on top where they're just trying to move their arm from 0 degrees to 30 degrees. And they have to do it within a certain time window. And we kind of want to make them do it fast because that way the inertia of the arm has some effect. And the inertia seems to be a big problem with bias in these patients. So a patient that has hypermetria means that they overshoot. And if a patient has hypometria, they undershoot. So it takes them longer to get to the target angle than it does for a control subject. And by the way, any version of or hypometria is called dysmetria. So what we were able to do using a model of the dynamics of the body, as well as a model of the whole control structure of the brain that would take errors in positions and feed them back in order to guess how people would correct movements, we can measure how control subjects would react if we suddenly use the robot to kind of render an inertia that made their arm feel heavier or lighter, or made it feel like it had more damping or less damping. And this is accomplished through my specialty, which is the field of haptics, which makes virtual environments feel a certain way. And so I just applied that to this very simple exoskeleton robot to make the robot feel lighter or heavier. But because it's an exoskeleton, it's really attached to the arm, it just makes the arm feel like it's lighter or heavier. And by perturbing a control subject, we can make them sort of look cerebellar, which is kind of neat. If you did it a long time, then control subjects will adapt and they'll start moving normally again. But if you just do it once, the first time, the control subject will look cerebellar. And we found that we could completely model that behavior. I'm not going to go through this block diagram, but we do have a whole control structure that allows us to model this behavior. So then, after we figured out what inertia errors might correspond to a particular amount of hypermetria or hypometria, we actually took those inertias and applied them to patients. So we had a patient make a reach in the robot, except we used the motors of the robot and controlled them in a manner to make the robot feel like it was lighter or heavier. And so if you look at, we can just look at group data, you know, before all the hypermetric patients might have errors versus zero that are high, and then by giving them the right amount of change in inertia, we manage to correct them. And then the same thing with hypometria, you can correct going this way. And so this is pretty striking because it's telling us that we had a model for the patient's deficit and we could use the dynamics of the robot to actually correct it. So we were able to find specific biases in patients' dynamics. We can replicate this using simulations, and we can partially correct by altering patient limb inertia. And what I mean by partially is that you still see a lot of variability here, even after correction. And so we can help with the bias, but we can't help with the variability. But still, it is striking that we've been able to prove some hypotheses about the role of the cerebellum in movement control. That was all just one degree of freedom. And we recently started doing multiple degrees of freedom, planar reaching. We call this the chicken foot reach. Reach three out and one back. And this is a patient, and we're trying to provide different kinds of compensation. And you can see that their variability is so high, it's actually really hard to drill down and see what's really going on there. And so we needed to study lots of patients in order to average out that variability. So we're just getting started with that. All right, so to conclude, maybe I'll just make a few points which don't just apply to rehab robotics, but apply to absolutely any medical robot, in my opinion, whether it's a surgical robot or a movement therapy robot. So for robots to really do their job as well as they can, we would like to have a quantitative description of patient state. And if you're doing a surgical robot, maybe that means how soft their tissues are, but in this case, it's what is the deficit in their brain. We'd like to use those models to plan an intervention, which might be changing the inertia of their limb appropriately, and then design systems that are going to connect that information to a physical action. And that, to me, is the definition of robots. We'd like to incorporate human input in a natural way and actually be able to use this to improve quality of life. So, of course, this big, clunky exoskeleton is not going to work in your kitchen. Can you make this into a wearable form? Or can you use this to create better virtual environments for training that might help these cerebellar patients learn to move better? And these are only the technical challenges. As you know, there are many, many social challenges and economic challenges as well. But hopefully this gives you some insight into how movement therapy robots work and the types of research that are trying to drill down towards the optimal way to use them. So thank you. Absolutely, and that would really be one of the end goals. You don't necessarily need to take that data and feed it into a rehab robot. It could be to some sort of game or other movement therapy environment. In fact, my lab is doing Kinect tracking. Anybody have a Kinect for their? I guess this one is that the PlayStation? That's the Xbox. I don't know. We don't have the Xbox part. We just hook it up to a computer. And we track the motion, and we have little vibrating tactors that are attached to the body which sort of push you, oh, no, you should move more that way or you should move more that way. It doesn't push you in the way that a robot would, but it gives you a little tactile signal that tells you which direction you should go. And, if we could use data acquired in order to drive those feedback mechanisms to help you move more appropriately, that would definitely be an important research goal. Thanks. Yeah, Rahul.
Did you ever try to use your like inertia and damping perturbations on a person without sort of
So we can change the inertia of a control subject, and they will move poorly. But after a few movements, just like if you pick up your heavy bottle of water, if you first try to make a quick movement, you're not going to make it so well. But if you keep practicing, eventually you will adapt to that changing dynamics, and then you will do fine. Interesting thing about cerebellar patients is they don't adapt very well either. But yeah, we do see effects on control subjects, just not for very long.
So it sounds like it's partially like the cerebellum is misunderstanding or representing what the body's model is, and part of it is
just think?
Its internal PID controller isn't being super robust.
So that's the interesting thing as well. At least our models, we think that the controller is okay, but the model around which the controller is poor. And here's why we think the controller is okay, is if the cerebellar patients move very, very slow, and in fact, cerebellar patients love to be in the water because the viscosity of the water helps them move very slowly. And if they move slowly, they can actually move decently accurately. It's during fast movements where there isn't really time for the closed-loop control to kick in. That's where they have the biggest movement deficits. So if they spent their whole lives moving very slowly, they might do okay, but who wants to do that? And there are things like walking where there's sort of unstable points where you just can't move too slow. That's what we would like to do. We'd like to design a device. The interesting thing is that if the idea is that we need to add inertia, maybe we can just add weights. We don't have enough details of how they might move in multiple degrees of freedom, but something like that could help. But it won't help their variability, so that part's still a mystery. There's a question here.
I was grasped. The robot that you described is really measuring, not assisting or fixing.
Yeah.
After you've got the measurement of what the problem is.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
What do you think you do about it?
Yeah. So the robot first measures, and then it can assist in this very limited way where it can change the dynamics of the arm. So the assistance is actually the robot effectively making the arm have more inertia, have more mass. But that is sort of a compensatory strategy. It's not something that the person can walk away from the robot and it still helps them. So it's not rehabilitation in that sense, but it's compensation. But the model now that we have of the cerebellum, we might be able to use to drive new strategies where they could do some kind of training in the robot, which then hopefully they could walk away from the robot and take with them. Or use some other mechanism like a video game with the Wii, like you mentioned. Yeah?
I have a similar question about feedback. As a stroke patient myself.
Yes. Absolutely. Yeah. So the rehab robot, well, one possibility is that by loss of repetition in the clinic with the robot assisting or resisting, that maybe that would change some brain circuitry in a way that would allow you to go home and do tasks normally. But I think what you're asking more about is ways that you could use that training in the home. And so having a robot that actually applies forces to you in all the degrees of freedom in which your arm can move, which you mentioned earlier, is really hard to build and super expensive. So that's why we've got this other project where we just have little vibrating motors, the same kind of pager motors that are inside your cell phone that make it vibrate, and we have little bands that you can put on your arms, and we're right now trying to see, can we get people to move in certain ways just by providing little vibration signals and by tracking their motion with the low-cost Kinect sensor, which can actually measure the configuration of the body in a non-contact way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely. So all of these techniques rely on the hope that you can use other brain circuits. Those will get reconnected through the practice, other than the ones that were originally damaged. Absolutely. Thank you. Yeah, it's CHARM, stands for Collaborative Haptics and Robotics in Medicine, charm.stanford.edu. Where I'm actually fairly new here, so it's not super populated, but you'll get the idea. Thanks. Yeah, I'm teaching the medical robotics next quarter. It's pretty much going to be about surgical robotics and sort of radiology type robots. So fortunately, no time for the rehab stuff. But it will involve one day of the week will be guest speakers. And actually, I don't have a class number yet, but I'll advertise it to the ME department as soon as I have it. And maybe I'll forward it to you. You can advertise it to the class. I know we're going over, so if you have to leave, I won't be offended.
Yeah.
That's interesting. In our study, we had patients just trying to move at a particular speed. In fact, we threw out all the trials where they weren't moving at that speed because we were trying to sort of equalize the challenge of the movement for every trial. But that said, altering the inertia actually alters the speed at which the patients would like to move. And while they love moving in viscosity, every time, whether it's a water or a virtual viscosity, the patients that we've worked with really love it, but it makes them move really slow. So in that case, with viscosity, there's this trade-off. With inertia, there isn't quite as much of a trade-off. It might take a little bit of time to get up to speed, more time to push against that inertia. But then it's also harder to slow down at the end, so the speed can kind of average out. Good question.
Well, I think we should
thank you.